Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight on our program, we have the next installment in our occasional series, Government from the Inside. And tonight we explore San Francisco's Department of Public Works, better known as DPW, with its head, Mohammed Nuru. It is hard to be a San Francisco resident and not be impacted by DPW every day. It's the agency in charge of streets, trees, and government buildings, the very infrastructure of the city. Responsibilities include the city's libraries and rec centers, as well as the building and maintenance of civic buildings such as San Francisco General Hospital and the War Memorial Opera House. The DPW is also taking the lead on the Better Market Street project, an attempt to revitalize San Francisco's transit and business corridor with better transportation and improved economic vitality. The agency's head, Mohammed Nuru, is a veteran of DPW, having spent 11 years there as deputy director of operations before being appointed interim director in 2011. And in March 2012, he was appointed to his current post as director. Prior to joining DPW, Mr. Nuru served as the executive director of the San Francisco League of Urban Gardeners, better known as SLUG. So tonight's discussion will cover the status of DPW's various projects around the city, the realities of budgets, constraints, and how the state of trees, streets, and buildings is and will be in the near future here in San Francisco. And as always, we'll welcome you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phones in about 20 minutes, and you have a chance to ask Mr. Nuru your questions about the city's streets, the city's trees, and other Department of Public Works projects. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, or you can post a comment at KLW website or on our Facebook page. So, Mr. Nuru, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So, I was looking over some statistics about what DPW does and what it's in charge of, and I was quite struck by some of the numbers. I was hoping you could start your comments by just giving us an overview of what your agency is responsible for, and if you could give it a little sense of scale or scope, that would be really helpful.
Okay. Well, again, thank you for having me on the air today. The Department of Public Works has got a little over 1,200 employees that work for it. And it's divided into four main sections. We have the operations part of Public Works, and the operations part actually manages all the maintenance of our streets, street cleaning, graffiti, and repair of many of our city facilities. That could be our police stations, that could be our libraries, could be any of the city departments that need some kind of maintenance work or some kind of repair. We have the building design and construction part of our Public Works Department, and the building design and construction actually designs many of the city's buildings and works with the various contractors to make sure that those buildings get built. As you said earlier, the library is one of our projects. We just finished the first phase of the cruise ship terminal. We're building the library down at North Beach and several other projects that involve architecture and design, including some landscape architecture projects for design of some of our parks and playgrounds and things of sorts. And then we have the infrastructure part of DPW, and this infrastructure part actually does all the design for many of our roads, many of our curb ramps, many of our street structures, whether they are stairs or bridges or things of sort, and they actually are the engineering section. And so that's one of our main businesses at DPW, is to make sure the infrastructure is well maintained and well designed. And then finally, the administration part of DPW, make sure we have the correct software, make sure all our staff are getting trained appropriately, up to date with new technologies, our bookkeeping, great crew there, making sure that we spend every dollar wisely, and helps us in tracking all the work that we do.
So tell us some of the trades that you employ, or the people from what trades you employ to manage this quite a broad portfolio of services.
So in the Department of Public Works, we have trades from carpenters to plumbers to laborers, truck drivers, sheet metal workers, engineers, architects, accountants, all sorts of trades that work in our agency.
And would you say, compared to other city agencies, that your agency has the broadest diversity of trades, or not? I'm just curious. It sounds like you have your hands in so many of the different pieces of what makes our city run.
Our core values, obviously, are to get things done. And so most people engage with the department by calling us either for some sort of emergency or need something to be delivered to them. And so depending on what the call is, if someone called for graffiti, then we'd be able to send someone out there right away to paint it. Or if you call for a pothole, we would send a laborer or asphalt team to go out and fix it. In some cases, we have a toilet not working somewhere, then we'll send a plumber out there. Mm-hmm. And then when we work with a lot of community groups, that normally brings in some of our designers that help solve some problems. It could be design of a park or a parklet. It could be, you know, some issue that has to do with a tree, then we'll send our arborists out. So, you know, most of our work is, you know, we take over 3,000 to 5,000 calls off 311. And, you know, so we are main responder.
That's per year?
No, that's per month.
Per month?
Per month, yeah. So, you know, we engage with the public, you know, mostly from calls and from needs of what people like to see happen to the quality of life in their neighborhoods.
And you work with, imagine, all of the other city agencies to kind of support the infrastructure of these agencies. Is that correct?
We have a very good relationship with many of the city agencies, whether it's the police department, the MTA, the planning department, the recreation parks department, human services. We have a very good relationship, and you know, we work to solve problems together.
Hmm. And is there anything listeners might be surprised to learn is under your department in terms of something that impacts their day-to-day life and they may not even know it, that DPW is sort of behind it?
Well, I mean, you know, if, you know, you have sewer overflow, you know, they call, you know, that's a DPW type of request that we'd be responding to. Or when there's a storm, a tree branch falls on your car, you know, DPW will be responding to make sure that the tree is well removed or taken care of. And so there are all sorts of stuff. All your trash cans have been managed by DPW. So whenever you see a trash can on the street, whether it's at a bus stop or on a street corner, you know, we have to make sure that those cans are emptied and they're clean and they're free from graffiti. And so there are all sorts of things that go on at DPW.
So let's talk about the funding for all of this varied work that you do. Obviously, all city departments had to face budget cuts in the recent economic downturn. And I've asked when I've had other department heads on the show recently, I've asked them how the economic downturn impacted the ability of their agency to do their job and what they see as the ability to do their job perhaps better now that things seem to be turning around a little bit.
So during the hard times, it was very difficult for us to keep up with a lot of the demands that we were getting from the public. So our response time was a little bit challenging. But I think as a department, one of the greatest things we've done is we've been able to build a very good partnership with many of the community groups and neighbors. So they are little simple things that we get a little extra help with. We have a lot of cleanups. We have a lot of graffiti paint out days. And we work with many neighbors to do some of the basic quality of life type of needs that the city has. And, you know, that has made a huge difference. We have a lot of followers. We go into various neighborhoods. And these community groups are always there to help give the city a hand. That has allowed us to stretch the extra mile in terms of addressing the quality of life concerns. A lot of our funding that got cut was in this area of quality of life, which is normally called the general fund, where your hotel taxes or property taxes kind of get shared amongst the departments, and we get a small piece of that. That was what was impacted the most. Now things are getting a little better. We have several programs that have led to some of our apprentice programs or training some of the people who have helped us work on many of these projects in these communities to become more professionals in fields that they like working. Our labor pool has been one of the bigger pools. We have over 30 people in apprentice program right now who are undergoing a two-year program who will become laborers. We also have people in a gardening apprentice program. We have people who are becoming asphalt workers. We just started a cement apprentice program. We're working on an electrical and a carpentry apprentice program. All these are people that we run into in the various neighborhoods when we go out to help clean the city and green the city. And those programs, these people who enroll in these programs end up going through these programs and end up becoming professionals. They end up joining the city workforce or are available to work for any of the larger projects that are going around San Francisco. So by going out and by engaging with community, we're able to build a good relationship and we're able to build a community and be able and we're able to bring people from those communities who can actually help build San Francisco. On the other side of the table, we've been very fortunate and very thankful to the people who live and vote in San Francisco. We've been able to pass many bonds, the library bond, a street paving bond, the earthquake and safety bond. All these bonds have provided funding for us to be able to implement many projects. Our engineers and architects are able to work on these projects, and we're able to, you know, to keep, you know, our organization going.
So, again, so a lot of the previous guests on this topic have said that, you know, they had to put off a lot of projects during the economic downturn and found that the money that they're now getting is still not quite enough for what they really need to be doing. Are you seeing that also in DPW? Do you feel like there really is there was a shortfall during the economic downturn, and even now with things turning around, that there's still a gap there, and you could probably use more to do the kinds of things you've been wanting to do? And what kinds of projects would those be like?
Well, as an organization, I think, you know, you can always you know, do more if you had more resources. But I think you also have to figure out how to run an organization with the resources you have. And for us, you know, is all the calls that we get, how can we respond to them and do our best in responding to those calls? It was tough, but, you know, the team understood the circumstances we were in, and everybody had to stretch and do a little bit more during those hard times. And so we were able to survive and get through through those hard times. We, we do measure how fast we respond and how well we respond. And, there are certain things that would normally take, few hours now would end up being days. But, you know, we're able to prioritize and we're able to get through those difficult times. That's where most people engage with us. The others are projects that we are, design and construction projects that would normally, you know, move at a certain pace. And like I said, during those hard times, we were actually lucky to be able to have quite a bit on our plate. And so I think San Francisco was one of the cities that was able to survive some of the hard times that we faced. Now with the turnaround, we're seeing more permits coming through. Our agency does also enforce work within the right-of-way. So all the construction projects are being inspected by many of our inspectors, and they go out. And so we're seeing a rise in construction, which is good for the city and is good for the economy. And, our staff are out there, and they're making sure that those projects are done safely. The path of travels are kept safe for people to walk on our sidewalks, to make sure that, the construction is done to the city standards.
So let's focus a moment now on one of the areas that I think a lot of people have some trouble with, which is the condition of our streets in terms of driving on our city streets. A lot of people grouse about the condition of the streets, a lot of potholes, bumpiness. Tell us, first of all, what is your take on the condition of the streets in San Francisco? And then from there, tell us, how do you think it got that way?
Well, streets in San Francisco could be a little better. I would start by saying that. But, San Francisco has got over 12,000 city blocks. And these, you know, we are a dense city, and so tear and wear on our city is something that we definitely need to pay attention to. And, you know, we have lots of buses, we have lots of infrastructure in a city like San Francisco. We're a growing city, and so every, you know, few years, you know, we cut our streets open, and then, you know, we patch them back, and, you know, and we're also a city that is very vulnerable to a little shaking also, you know, as you know. Fortunately for San Francisco, the way streets are graded, we have what's called a pavement index scoring system. And so every year our engineers go out and they score the conditions of the streets. And based on the scores that they have, those scores actually reflect what streets we should be working on. And the streets are also categorized whether they're residential streets, arterial streets, or collectors. And those are defined by use or width of each street. With the paving bond, we were very fortunate to that the voters have trusted us to move forward and repair many of the streets that are in worse condition. Traditionally, we would be paving, I would say, anywhere from 350 to 400 streets every year. With the bond, now we're going to about 700 to 800 streets that we will be paving. The bond does cover us to do paving and street resurfacing for 3 years. So you would be seeing roughly about, you know, 2,400 city blocks that will receive improvements, you know, over time. Infrastructure is something we work with other agencies, and we all coordinate and make sure that all those agencies can get in and do their infrastructure work. So things like gas or electric or water or sewer line, we try to make sure that they're all done before we pave a street. What that does is that does give the street a little longer life, and, you know, hopefully we won't have to come in and, you know, tear up the street or do something that might be needed. There are emergencies that do come up, and the city does have ordinances that say when there's an emergency or somebody tears into a street, there's a certain type of repair that needs to be done. And, you know, so we are getting better. Our score is going up in the right direction, but, you know, it's taking a while, and hopefully if we continue at this pace over the next 5 years, we should be able to have a much better score, but we'll also have more smoother streets for people to drive on.
So I just wanted to point to something that I noted in the Chronicle that states that San Francisco spends more money per resident on streets than any other major city. It's quoted as $59 per person, which is, you know, many times higher than other cities. Could you explain that, why that difference in how much? First of all, do you agree with that? And then secondly, why so much of a difference?
So, first answer, yes, I agree with that. Secondly, we're not similar to some of the cities in the rural areas or less dense cities. When you have a dense city like San Francisco, the paving of a street is not all that a street really deserves. As you know, in San Francisco, because of our density, we have sidewalks, we have curb ramps, we have to make our sidewalks accessible, and so we have to build curb ramps with every street. We also have curbs. There are many cities that don't have curbs. And so the infrastructure cost begins to increase for every mile of street work that needs to be done. And then, of course, then, you know, we're taking it up to the next notch where we're starting to bring trees in to many of our streets, and we're starting to bring some more beautification projects into many of our city sidewalks. You know, so the way we look at things in San Francisco is we look at a complete street, not just a paving of a street, but we look at all the infrastructure, we look at the paving, and then we look at the beauty of the street and how it fits into our neighborhoods.
But not to belabor this point, but my understanding was that this was comparing with cities like Chicago and other cities that sound like they have a similar kind of issues in urban landscape. So I'm trying to get a sense of why you think San Francisco is set apart.
Well, I think the other cost involved in San Francisco is, we know we have a lot more hills in San Francisco, and when you build streets on hills, you have to use more concrete, because the asphalt definitely doesn't, you know, on a flat ground it's much easier to use asphalt. When you have hills, you have to actually use concrete, and so you know, using concrete is a little bit more expensive than asphalt. I think that's definitely one major type of cost that's involved. You know, and then our infrastructure, of course, we have to protect our infrastructure. And so going up hills, you know, can add cost.
And how about labor costs? Do you feel like that's a factor in this case compared to other cities?
Compared to other cities like San Francisco, I think we're in range in terms of labor costs. But, you know, it is a little harder to work in a city like San Francisco. You know, you have to come across the bridge, you know, or if people, you know, we've worked very hard to create ordinances where we try to encourage people who live here to get jobs who work here. You know, there's, you know, the cost of living, like any major city, whether it's New York or, you know, or Chicago, it's high. There's dues that need to be paid, and, you know, the cost for permits and all these sorts of things that are going to a development can end up, you know, rising. But, you know, compared to cities of this side, I think we're pretty reasonable.
In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight we're speaking with the head of San Francisco's Department of Public Works, Mohammed Nuru. Our number to the number to dial to join our conversation this evening is 415-841-4134. If you live in San Francisco or pass through San Francisco at any point in your day or week, then you've been touched by the work of DPW. So you probably have a question or comment for Mohammed Nuru. This is the time to call. 415-841-4134. Or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. You can post a comment on the KLW website or on our Facebook page. So let's go to another area that I was curious about. I was looking at your budget projections over the next couple of years, and you have about $27 million in projected revenues. Where do you get your revenues from?
A lot of our revenues are from fees, permits, whether they are cafes that have sidewalk tables and chairs. Yeah. Or parklets.
Oh, or also tables and chairs.
Yeah, tables and chairs. You know, to have a table, you know, outside your restaurant, there's a fee for that. And, you know, people pay a yearly fee. You can have parklets, you know, and there's a small fee for that, as we encourage that. But a lot of, you know, the revenue comes from permits, excavation permits, and people doing construction around the city. We get quite a bit of revenue from that. In general, you know, we also issue a lot of citations and fines that also generate some revenue for people who do not follow city ordinances or codes.
And what are some new areas of revenue that you're looking towards?
New areas of revenue, you know, obviously there are areas where people are not following city ordinances that we're spending a little bit more time on. And so
you mean on enforcement?
Enforcement. Mm. Yeah, enforcement is an area that we're looking at revenue. We are really working hard to change the behavior of a lot of people who litter or don't have garbage service. You know, there's a huge number of people that don't have garbage service in San Francisco. And, you know, the law does require every resident to have garbage service and things of sort. So, you know, we're out there doing enforcement. We walk many of our city commercial corridors. We walk many areas. We do... you know, we do get a lot of complaints about trash, and in areas of non-compliance, we definitely will send a notice, and that could end up being a fine. So we're going to be out there. We're going to have more people out there. We're going to have more people making sure that San Francisco is a livable city, and we'll be doing everything we can.
415-841-4134. That's the number to dial to join our conversation. You can also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Post a comment on our webpage at klw.org or on our Facebook page. Let's go to our first caller. Jane, I imagine you're from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Mr. Nehru, I live very close to a Mecca tourist attraction, the Crooked Street of Lombard. And I call in because I'm interested in why my neighborhood, Russian Hill, has half underground utilities and half coils and old-fashioned boxes and lines that cause the people at one end of the Crooked Street to say we're very high-tech and we have a nice infrastructure. Then you go down to the bottom, and it's really third world and ugly and embarrassing. What kind of line item do you have in your DPW budget for completing what I thought was going to be a citywide project for undergrounding all utilities, like they have in Europe?
So undergrounding, first of all, thanks for the question. Undergrounding is, I think, it's something that everyone desires. You know, it definitely is a process where, you know, when all our wires are underground, you have nice views, and you know, you don't see the unsightliness of utilities. The problem here is it's very, very expensive. A few years ago, the city undertook a partnership with the utility companies and the city, and attempted to do about 42 miles of undergrounding. The cost of it is enormous, and trying to figure out who should pay for it really becomes the question that is always at the table. You know, the city does expect the homeowners or the property owners to participate in putting forth some of that cost. And unfortunately, the first round, it was really an expensive type of venture that a lot of property owners could not contribute. And the city itself does not have any money to do undergrounding, and utility companies are not willing to put up any of the funding. But I do agree that undergrounding definitely improves the quality of life, and definitely is something that everyone desires. But the cost is just prohibitive.
And just to follow up on that, is there, from a seismic perspective, is there a benefit to undergrounding compared to having electricity wires above ground?
Oh, yes. I mean, if it's underground, it's much easier to access. You know, when you have an earthquake or a huge wind, you know, anything that's above ground has a tendency to fall or break, and then it could fall on somebody's house. It's, you know, it's live wire. It's all dangerous. Well, that stuff that's in the ground is a little bit much easier to manage. There are still some concerns, but it's a lot much easier to also maintain. You can just go to the box, you know, and work on it.
So any hope for undergrounding anytime soon?
Well, I think, you know, those discussions are around. I mean, it's all a matter of cost. You know, there are some neighborhoods that have taken it upon themselves to underground. And, you know, their streets look, you know, very nice. You know, it's something that we would need to work out with utility companies.
So perhaps Jane could organize her Russian Hill neighbors to see if they could chip in.
Yes.
Thanks, Jane, for your call. 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 to join our conversation tonight. Feedback at cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment at klw.org or our Facebook page. Let's go next to Dale. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have a question about street cleaning related matters. I work in Hunters Point, and there's a lot of trash that accumulates, seems like on a nightly basis. There's a lot of public dumping in the neighborhood. And it just seems to me like if the city were to install cameras, for instance, they'd avoid a tremendous amount of reactive labor.
Okay, thanks so much for your call. So let's talk about dumping.
Okay, dumping. Dumping in Hunters Point or in the southeast sector of San Francisco has been a huge problem. Most contractors on their way to Tunnel Road look for areas to go dump. So we are aware of the problem of people dumping. We've worked very, very hard to try and catch those who are dumping. We've actually tried various camera projects, and what happens is the technology has to be so very sophisticated, because what happens is these guys are sophisticated. I mean, the people who are dumping are very sophisticated. They don't just go anywhere, and you have to move with them. And so we've had a few cameras over the years that I've been down at the operations We have put cameras up at various locations, and what happens is they move locations, and then it becomes a cost in terms of moving the camera. Occasionally, we have been able to make a few arrests, but you're talking about chasing a sophisticated group of people who, you know, are very familiar with the area, and they know where to go or where not to go. Our police department has been very helpful in tracing some of these dumpings. We, from the Department of Public Works, actually look at the material that's being dumped, and we actually go in and try and see if we can get any evidence of where the dumping has come from. If we do get evidence, we're able to turn that over to our city attorney's office, and our city attorney's office will continue with an investigation, and hopefully in the end we'll get an arrest. But you're right, dumping is a huge problem in the southeast part of San Francisco, and we're doing our best to tackle it, and we'll just continue doing it. But cameras are very expensive, and they haven't proved to work because it's very hard to put a face on camera to the person dumping.
And this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at kalw.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight we are speaking with Department of Public Works Director Mohammed Nuru in our occasional series, Government from the Inside. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com, post a comment at klw.org, or also on our Facebook page. So just to go back to the street situation again, we have an email from Zach saying, how are San Francisco streets compared to 20 years ago? And I don't know that you could be able to tell us that, but if you had a guess.
Well, San Francisco is a changing city. And, as I said earlier on the show, our streets are measured by a pavement index type of scoring system. And so the worst ones get treated first. And then we try to maintain them as long as we can for the life of a street. The life of a street is 20 to 25 years or so. But we've had a lot of tear and wear of our streets. Mm-hmm. We've had, huge trucks coming into our city. We've had, changing of various buses in our, in San Francisco. Some of the buses we had early on were far much heavier. And so, as we design our streets, we definitely try to make sure that they are designed to meet the tear and wear that we have. Mm-hmm. And so compared to 20 years ago, we've seen more cars coming into the city. We've seen more tear and wear. So I think we're having a little bit more of a harder time trying to keep up with the, with the use. But, with all the work that we're doing now we have also doubled our street repair. 20% of our streets will get repaved or some kind of resurfacing, in the next 3 years. And, with the leadership of our mayor, he's trying to continue that. Our mayor was a public works director. He understands the need, and he's setting the vision, to continue that pace of street repair. And, hopefully you'll have a smooth ride in coming years.
Are certain neighborhoods prioritized over others?
It's not by neighborhood. It's actually by condition of streets. And every neighborhood gets a little bit of everything, but it's really by condition of street and by need. And, the overall scores of our streets actually add up to one score. And so we have a score that we try to meet. Last year, we were at 64. We were able to go up 1 point because of all the work that we have done over the last year. We're projecting to go up another 2 points or so over the next 2 years, and that will get us to about 68. The pavement, desirable is above 70. So we're on the right track, and, it takes quite a bit of work, but, we're doing our best to make sure that those funds that the voters passed are being used wisely and that the most streets in dire need are getting done first.
Okay. And our phone lines are currently full, but keep on trying, or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Let's go next to RJ. Welcome to the program. RJ.
I am calling about the alleyways south of Market Street. And a lot of I read an article in the Chronicle recently about a lot of business owners complaining that they're having the human waste problems in the alleyways. Is this something that falls under your purview?
Yes, by default. The Department of Public Works, we are out there. We run a 24/7 operation, and we do take those calls from the from 311 when people call about someone has defecated or something has happened on the sidewalks. And in many cases, it happens in these alleyways. Alleyways are a challenge, I think, for the department and for the city, because they have become places where people either hang out or hide. And, you know, because when they're on streets, you know, they're more visible. And so they go to places that are less desirable. We do our best to clean up. And, you know, my response to your question would be to please continue to call us as we begin to find out where most people hang out in many of these alleyways. Then we are able to respond faster, but we're also able to see where we're spending more resources and figure out what solutions are for some of these alleys. In some of these alleys or dead end streets, we've been able to put up gates so that people do not go in to some of these spaces, and only people who are supposed to be there can go in there. In other cases, we're able to partner with the police to tell people that they can't be laying on the sidewalk or they can't be in some of these places. But it is a challenge. I mean, there are quite a large number of people who are on our streets in the downtown area, and unfortunately, they have using alleys, to do things that many neighbors do not expect. It is probably one of the hardest parts of our job, but we respond, we try to disinfect and try to make it safe for people to walk.
Do you ever partner with other city agencies to see how you can work to find solutions for these individuals who are doing this, perhaps people who are homeless or otherwise have challenges being able to, you know, find a toilet?
Oh, yes. We partner with the mayor's with the mayor's outreach program on homeless. We partner with the Department of Public Health. We partner with the police department. So we have a lot of meetings where we try to figure out solutions for some of these what we call hotspots. And so, you know, as we collect data and as we see where quite a number of people are gathering, you know, we definitely try to respond. I think we recently just did a major cleanup on King Street where we actually, you know, over time worked with the people who were living under the freeway, tried to get them into the right type of housing, ended up doing some fence work around there and cleaning up the area. And now we have the police making regular passes in the area just to make sure that, you know, people don't come back to that location.
415-841-4134. Let's continue with the street cleaning theme with Scott. Welcome to the program, Scott. Scott, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good evening, and thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I wanted to first thank the city for putting all those nice curbs, those wheelchair curb ramps in every single corner. At first, when that was going on, I didn't like it at all. But now I've come around, and I think it's a good thing. I live out in the Bayview District, actually, out on Van Dyke Avenue. And I noticed recently, within the past year or two, they changed the way that we're required to park. We used to be able to park parallel, but now we have to park perpendicular. And it creates quite a bit of...
You're breaking up there, Scott.
Yeah. It creates quite a bit of danger because the cars go zooming in and out, and sometimes the cars get smashed as they're parked there on the street. And so sometimes we pull up a little bit, and then the police come by and give us a ticket for parking on the sidewalk, even though the car is not actually having the wheels on there. It's just hanging over a little bit. And I noticed that the guest had indicated that you're trying to change the behavior of the people in San Francisco by enforcement. So I'm wondering what sort of behavior we're trying to change here by ticketing people who pull up their car a little bit to keep it from being smashed by cars racing by.
Okay, thanks so much for your call.
So thanks for the question. This obviously is a question that I would defer to our sister agency, to the Transportation Authority. We are not in the parking or ticketing of cars. We're the Public Works Department. But I would say you know, we work together, and when we change parking, either perpendicular or diagonal, it's something that comes out of a process that involves the community for certain reasons, either for more parking or for efficiencies that we need to get. And I would be glad to just forward your complaint to the MTA, and, you know, we'll have them look at it.
Okay. And we're City Visions here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight we're speaking with the director of the Department of Public Works here in San Francisco, Mohammed Nuru. It's time for your questions and comments as we've been taking them. 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com for emails, or you can post a comment at klw.org or on our Facebook page. So let's go next to Karen. Karen, welcome to the program.
Oh, yes. Good evening, gentlemen. And what I'm calling about is I've noticed this not just in San Francisco, but in Oakland and Alameda and Berkeley and all over, is that the Department of Public Works, which is in charge of the street trees, cuts them off horizontally with a chainsaw so that they're lopped off parallel to the ground, not pruned by arborists, as it, you know, it appears that way, but just kind of just flattened out along the top. And this is some sort of a pop. I've actually seen it out in Concord and Walnut Creek, all over the Bay Area, as a form of pruning trees. And it's very, it looks like the tree has been mutilated or butchered or really not paid attention. And it generally happens in January or February, in the month right before the spring comes, when the birds are getting ready to make their nests. So these trees are then denuded and brutalized and don't give the cover to migrating and native birds that look for cover and a place to put their nests. So I wondered if you knew about that and if your department was engaged in that and how you felt about it.
Okay, thanks so much, Karen, for your call.
Thank you for the question. I really don't know a lot about what other counties are doing, but I can speak for San Francisco County. We have a very qualified staff. We have arborists on staff. We have an urban forester for the whole city on staff. And in fact, we go out and we find people who butcher trees the way you described in your call. And we do, you know, we do want to make sure that trees are pruned correctly by these international arborist standards. And so in San Francisco, actually, to the question that we received earlier, we do generate quite a bit of revenue from finding people who butcher trees or who cut them the way you said in your, you know, in your call. We actually provide pruning standards, and we follow our pruning standards. And we are out there. We have people that patrol the streets every day. And if you see anyone in San Francisco committing such an act of butchering a tree, please call 311. That call will get to us, and we will get an inspector out there, and we will definitely make sure that we don't lose many of our healthy trees that we really don't have a lot of at this time.
So that leads nicely into the next sort of potential area of controversy, which is DPW and the city shifting responsibility of maintaining trees to property owners. And perhaps driving this problem. Maybe property owners don't really know how to prune trees, or I don't know if they're hiring people to prune them. That I'm just curious, how is that going, and what kind of feedback have you received from property owners about the city's shift of maintaining trees towards property owners?
So let me put this in perspective first. I wouldn't call it a shift. Currently, within our city's right-of-way, there's about 100,000 trees. Those 100,000 trees, there's 65,000 that are being maintained by property owners. So 65, so more than half property owners are looking after. There's another 7,500 or so trees in our mediums, and then there's about another 28,000 trees that the city is maintaining. Of the 28,000 trees that the city is maintaining, there's about 21,000 that belongs to property owners. And so this is where the debate is. Hmm. The city is relinquishing trees, those 21,000 trees, back to the property owners because the city for many years has been looking after those trees. The relinquishment is something that came about when our resources got cut.
And were they once cared for by property owners, and then the city took this on and now is giving it back? You say relinquishment.
Yeah, relinquishment. So this 21,000 trees are the trees that are being talked about. And so to be able to turn a tree back to a property owner, the city has to make sure that the tree is pruned to meet the standards, that the sidewalk around it is not in any danger of trip and fall hazards or things of sort. The Public Works Code says to be able to give that tree back to the property owner, which the code does says we can do, we have to give it back in order, if you would call it that way. And so the process of relinquishment is turning over the tree. The reason why the city is turning over the tree back to the property owner is because, one, we don't have the resources to continue looking after the trees that we are actually responsible for. Our pruning cycles that should be 3 to 5 years is now we're going to a 7 to 9 year cycle and even bigger. That means the city's trees are also suffering. The other big part of the conversation is that you already have 65,000 trees that are being looked after by property owners. So you could go down 2 or 3 blocks and the property owners are looking after their trees, and then you go down the 4th block and the city's looking after the property owner's tree. So we definitely need to bring some equity in the maintenance of trees. With that said, I am not one that believes that property owners should be looking after trees, because we will begin to see different types of pruning and different types of maintaining of these trees. And so, I'm one that believes that the city should look after all the trees. And I think the debate there is, we do not have the resources to look after all the trees. If we had the resources, we could definitely make sure that these trees are well maintained and, in return, obviously provide a much healthier corridor for many of our trees.
So how do you imagine solving this problem?
Well, we have to do a little bit more education on what it takes to look after a tree and who's best to maintain the tree. I think, if property owners can contribute some sort of funding to help the city be able to look after trees that frankly increase the value of their properties, and they get all the benefits, all the environmental benefits, they become nice nesting area for birds, they provide oxygen, some of these trees flower, all the beautiful things that a tree does increase the value of their property. The city just does not have enough resources to look after these 100,000 trees. And by some kind of partnership or some kind of fee with property owners, I think we'll be able to do it. We're exploring all different ways that we can figure out how to maintain all the trees within our right-of-way. But what's being worked out now is there are some people who have to do it themselves, and they get fined and they're held, responsible for not maintaining their trees. And we have a small group of people that the city's been looking after their trees. And so I think just to bring even playing field, we're trying to make sure that all property owners are looking after their trees, and the city then can look after the trees that it's responsible for, and then hopefully, we'll figure something out as we go forward. But it is a discussion that many of our supervisors have on the table and our mayor, and we're trying to figure it out.
Okay. And we have a potential suggestion, I think, from Jonathan here in San Francisco. Jonathan, you have an idea perhaps for how we can deal with this tree maintenance problem?
Well, it's really a community issue. I used to manage buildings for TNDC, and there are a lot of children.
The Tenderloin Neighborhood Development Corporation. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, we have probably the largest percentage of children in this neighborhood, of any part of town, really. And as the trees are being planted in the sun, I'm talking about street trees, street plantings, it would help. I mean, from experience, I've learned it would help if some of the children were involved in just maybe throwing a handful of dirt in with a tree or something. They become the defenders of trees in the future as they grow up. And this old tradition of seeing trees as maybe bad things, feng shui or anything, in the Richmond and the Sunset. That would maybe be slightly altered if there was any way to involve kids. Okay?
Okay, thank you so much for your call. That just reminds me to slip in before we go to the next caller here. Let's
go to another area, which is graffiti removal. So does the city is the city responsible for removing graffiti just from public property, or they also remove graffiti from private property?
So graffiti on either public or private property, the Department of Public Works has the responsibility of informing the property owner of the graffiti. If it is on public property, the agency, upon being notified, has got 48 hours to remove the graffiti from its property. That was an executive order that was passed a few years ago. We monitor compliance for how well the city agencies are removing graffiti, and we're also there to be able to help them. Many of these agencies actually work order money to the Department of Public Works, and so we are there to be able to provide the service. For private property, is a little bit different. For private property, you actually get what's called a notice of violation. And when you're given a notice of violation, you're given a certain number of days, depending on where your property is. If you're on a major commercial corridor, you're given 15 days to abate the graffiti on your property. And if you're in one of the residential areas, you're given 30 days to abate graffiti on your property. Failure to abate the graffiti on your property then allows the city to come in and actually abate the graffiti for you and then charge you for providing the service. The city has got programs where people actually go out and help you match paint for your building if you ask for it. As part of these violations, there's also hardships that can come with them. And, you know, when you get the notice, you can actually come to City Hall and say, you know, I'm getting tagged all the time. You know, every time I clean it, I'm spending all this money and I'm just not getting anywhere. You know, we have a hearing officer that will hear what you have to say about that. And then they would advise on whether the city should then engage more and try to figure out some of the solutions.
So is the graffiti protocol something you can perhaps parlay into the tree maintenance protocol? I'm wondering, right? You're on the one hand, you're asking property owners to take care of things on their own. And then in this other case, in graffiti, you'll come in and charge them, but at least things get done.
Yeah. And, with graffiti, you know, our response is over 75% of people respond just upon receiving the notice. And people are really doing a good job. I think we are shifting. You know, if you look around San Francisco, you don't see it as much as you used to. But we also have a lot of education programs where we're spending time with a lot of these people who deface people's property. And we're trying to engage artists and young people into doing more creative stuff and looking for spaces for them to do their type of stuff. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, matching them with property owners to do some good programs. We do need to do a little bit more work with our trees, and we're doing everything we can.
Okay, we're going to go next back to a topic we talked about a little while ago, which was about the dumping in the southeast corridor of the city. Let's go to George. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi, George.
Hi. I object to something that Mr. Noering said about the dumping problem in Bayview, I guess, or Hunters Point. And that is that he said that most contractors on their way to the dump on Tunnel dump illegally. Most contractors do this. That's not true at all. And I think what he's doing there is demonizing all of us for what a few people do, which is not right. And that's like kind of a, you know, a one-size-fits-all approach the city's taking. Demonizing all contractors for that, it's not right. We pay enough fees and all the rest of it.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much, George, for your call. Want to respond to that?
Well, there is a fraction. I would agree that, you know, maybe most is not the word that I should have used, but there is quite a number of contractors who choose not to go and pay the fees at Tunnel, but instead go into our neighborhoods and dump, truckloads of, mostly building material. Some of it is even toxic. And, and that costs a lot of money for us to clean up. And it's mostly people who are working downtown who, you know, towards evening come into the various neighborhoods, here in Hunters Point or sometimes in Visitation Valley. And, we firsthand have to deal with it. So I can tell you, you know, I've seen many of these dumps. These are not, household, couches or computers. These are building materials of people who are working downtown. And yes, we have been able to nab a few of them. And, our city attorney has helped us move forward with some kind of prosecution. But
so it sounds like it's some but not all, just to make to clarify to George's point.
I'll take that, yes.
Okay. Let's go next to Lynn. Welcome to the program. Lynn?
Oh, yes. This is Lynn. I was just trying to figure out if the timing of the light is this department.
No, that would be the MTA. They will do all the traffic timing for lights for bicycles and buses and cars.
Can you tell me that name again?
The MTA, that is okay. The Municipal Transportation Authority.
Okay. Well, under that case, then, I just wanted to thank you. I'm originally from Boston, and the roads there are a nightmare. And I've lived in San Francisco for 25 years, and I've noticed a lot of improvements over those 25 years. So despite the bad condition of the surface of the road, I want to thank you. And also, if you have anything to do with San Francisco becoming more bike-friendly, that's been a great thing for me. So I really appreciate it.
I believe that's MTA as well.
Well, it's been great.
All right. Thanks so much, Lynn, for your call. So we have an email from Doug. He says, please ask Mr. Nuru how successful slurry seal has been for streets that are marginally deteriorated. It has been applied on a number of street surfaces in my neighborhood with great success. So first of all, what is slurry seal?
So slurry seal is I call lipstick on a street. Slurry seal does add life to a street about 5 years. Slurry seal is a very successful way of maintaining streets. And as part of our repaving program, we have done some slurry seal of some of our city blocks. We're looking at doing more slurry seal to give our streets longer life. The concerns with slurry seal is, you know, how long it lasts, and when you slurry seal, it's not. We get a lot of complaints. People stepping on the slurry seal and then walking onto the sidewalk, and in some cases going into their houses, and then we get tons of claims with slurry seal. Yeah, and so it is a much easier, and it does give some life to a street. And so we contract all our slurry seal work out, and we have been successful. And as we look at our strategy for changing the conditions of the street, we're actually looking at doing more slurry seal, but with a little bit thicker slurry seal, so that we can get a little bit more life to our streets. And then using the money that we would be saving to do some of our streets that are in worse repair. Mm-hmm. So by slurry sealing, we're buying a few more years instead of building newer streets, and being able to do less, we'll be able to do more.
I want to just get in before we have to go. The Greater Green Project, which is to try to change the materials that are used in sidewalks. Can you speak about that?
So sidewalk landscaping is one of our Greater Green projects. The Department of Public Works has launched programs where property owners are encouraged to remove some of the concrete on their sidewalk as long as they maintain the standard path of travel, which is a minimum of 4 feet. Any extra space there, we will give you a permit so that you can green the city. Mm-hmm. It has got many advantages, not just for beautification of the city, but it also helps collect a lot of the rainwater that will run off. It will help water these plants, but it will also reduce the amount of water that would go into our storm system.
And this is sidewalk. How about projects that are looking to also change the curbside of the street?
The curbside of
meaning
the street.
Meaning the part of the street that's actually the curb, next to the curb, with changing it with brick as opposed to asphalt. Is it also a way to collect rainwater?
Yeah, so we're looking at a lot of permeable surfaces. It could be brick. It could be permeable sidewalk. A lot of homeowners and a lot of developers are bringing in a lot of ideas. We've been very supportive of these permeable type of ideas that help retain stormwater. And
in the last 30 seconds, anything that you've seen other cities do that you'd love to bring to a DPW project near you here in San Francisco?
There's lots of things that I've seen other cities do.
The one
I like is in Taipei, where if you receive a ticket, you can go in to a 7-Eleven and pay for it.
How interesting. Well, it seems like enforcement is on your mind, but it sounds like a lot of other projects as well. So I want to thank you, Mohammed Nuru, my guest this evening, for joining me. It's been great talking with you.
Thank you very much for having me on the show.
And that's City Visions for this evening. For a link to this and other shows to let us know what you thought about tonight's program and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was Debbie Kennedy. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Our executive producer is Susie Britton. We'll be away next week. Join us on Monday, April 8th, as we discuss the challenges the Bay Area is facing with its water supply. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.